Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 303. My name is Camden Busey. I'm the pastor of Hope Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Grays Lake, Illinois, just north of O'Hare Airport. We're delighted to be back on the program. I have a good panel with me today and an excellent guest. Let me introduce to you everyone that we have with us online. We have first Jim Cassidy, who is a pastor of Calvary OPC in Ringgoes, New Jersey. Welcome back, Jim. It's great to speak with you again.
It's good to be here with you, as always.
Yes. We also have David Filson, who is teaching pastor at Christ Presbyterian Church in Nashville, Tennessee. It's a PCA congregation down there. Welcome back, David. It's great to speak with you as well.
So good to be with y'all.
You are our ecumenical brother today.
Is that right?
Yes.
Y'all take it easy on me.
Okay.
the token PCA guy.
Yeah, the token PCA guy, which is about as far as we stretch out often. We need to get some more URC NA folks in here and some Covenanters. But because we have with us a third OPC guy, we have welcoming back to the program Dr. Daryl Hart, who is visiting assistant professor of history at Hillsdale College. He's also an elder at Hillsdale OPC there, and you guessed it, Hillsdale, Michigan. Welcome back, Daryl. It's great to speak with you.
Thanks. Good to be with you, Camden.
It's been some time, and we are excited to have you and very delighted to speak about your new book. We have a book in front of us here by Dr. Hart entitled Calvinism, A History. It is from Yale, Yale University Press, and we are going to be opening this excellent book up today to speak about Calvinism in its global context, going all the way back to at least the Reformation and bringing it up to the present day, exploring all of the contours that we can fit into an hour here. So we'll get into that in a minute. But just to begin, I do need to mention that Christ the Center is listener-supported. Please visit us online at reformedforum.org/donate today to pledge your support. We need your support now more than ever. We have some needs and some projects coming up. We also need to support the people that help us, including our editor, Joel Carini. So please contribute today to help us continue to do everything that we love to do and to produce and distribute all of these programs free of charge. Online today at reformedforum.org/donate. We thank you so much for your support of everything we do at Christ the Center and our network, Reformed Forum. Well, I do need to begin, Daryl, by one, as I already have done, thanking you for writing this book, but I wanted to get an understanding, and I would like to give you an opportunity to speak to our listeners about the overall scope and intent of this book. Now, you were asked an approach to write this, were you not?
Yes. Yeah, Yale came to me many years ago now. They had tried someone else who then gave me gave them my name. And so they wanted a one-volume, standalone, comprehensive overview, summary, history, narrative of Calvinism that would be as lively as possible. Even something that people might take to the beach, which is
a tall order.
Well, it's not exactly something I think people would take a book on Calvinism to the beach. But anyway, that's what they were going for. So they didn't want it overly academic, and they wanted it to be as narrative driven as possible, and not a lot of analysis.
You could do, what is that, Sue Grafton or something? You could do one of those C is for Calvinism or something, the beach reads like that. That might have worked better.
right, exactly. And I've got plenty of ideas now for sequels, but
P is for
anyway.
Predestinated. Yeah. Well, this is definitely a useful book, and not only useful, but enjoyable, and it provides a nice overview of Calvinism. From a perspective, I'm not so sure if I have another book on my shelf that does a similar thing. It's quite useful and really exciting to get into. Guys, now, Jim, you've read this book as well. What was your initial take on it?
I thought it was really, really helpful. I don't know if I would take it to the beach with me.
At least not in hardcover. I mean, it needs if you go wait for paper, then okay. But
yeah, I might drop it in the ocean, knowing my track record.
You know, guys, I took Darren McCullough's book on the Reformation to the beach last summer when I was prepping for comprehensive exams. I kid you not.
Gee.
I took it to the beach and I was reading it on the beach. My wife was so unimpressed with me for the
That's rough.
You're a geek, man.
That's an important book, but
that's well established.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, no, this is great stuff. There's an opening line. You know, it's one of those things where it has you wishing for greater analysis, because as the narrative unfolds, it is written at a pace where you can keep up with it, and it's just really enjoyable, and you're just dying for a little bit of analysis. There is a little bit in the introduction which is really good. Daryl, you say this. It did so, speaking about the Reformed Protestantism circumnavigating the planet. It did so not by underwriting the political and economic forces of the modern West or by preaching humanitarian ideals, but through the ordinary and often accidental efforts of average pastors and lay people. Mm. As an average and oftentimes accidental pastor myself, I really enjoyed that little comment. I thought it was just great. Would you be able to talk a little bit about that comment, perhaps being able to dig up what you were thinking at the time when you wrote that, in terms of analyzing the overall global history of Calvinism?
Right. Well, I guess I was really impressed while trying to put the pieces together, and I have to say there wasn't a lot of original research. I had to rely on a lot of other secondary sources, other historical narratives, because I don't know French and German, and I don't know Scottish either, but I'm not sure it's a language. but for the sake of, say, needing two pages on what was happening in Scotland in the 1720s, I had to go to other sources. I couldn't just get into the archives. But looking at these other accounts, and some of them were hard to find, and I really sort of have some criticisms of church history profession, not that it really is doing that well, why people don't write, say, I'm going to do 19th century Scottish church history and just do a kind of big overview, or I'm going to do a book on the Puritans in Massachusetts and just sort of do it from beginning to some endpoint. But in putting this all together, trying to still answer Jim's question, I guess I was struck by how accidental Reformed Protestant history is, that, you know, Calvin was very reluctant in going to Geneva, and I think Geneva turned out in many respects much differently than Calvin may have intended, much better by the late 1550s and 1560s, but no one would have predicted that, say, that the monarch of England would turn up the fire on Protestants and force them onto the continent in exile, and have them then live in Geneva for a while, and have Geneva be this home for refugees, and have them then see what was going on in Geneva, and using that to inspire, say, Puritans in the late 16th century back in England, but have them also then become frustrated with how far reforms could go in the Church of England. So when you start to put all these different pieces together and see the attempts at reformed churches from Poland to England and then beyond that around the world, I was very much struck by how it required the work of very ordinary people. I mean, some of those, you know, are sort of celebrated in our circles. When you think about the beginnings of Presbyterianism in what became the United States, Francis McAmee, mm-hmm. who was a Scots-Irish minister who came here and tried to put together some churches and helped put together the First Presbytery. He's somewhat celebrated, but he's not very well known. Or Boehm, who was basically the founder of the German Reformed mm-hmm. Church in the United States. Again, there are books about him. His journal has been republished. But he's not a household name by any means in Reformed or Presbyterian households.
Yeah, exactly.
And these are sort of the big figures, as it were. So, you know, how much more then when you talk about, say, Reformed church life in Indonesia or Korea or in Washington State, which I don't really get to, but you know, it really was a collection of people who were organized around planting churches and ministering God's word that wound up, you know, forming communions, some of whom still have ties internationally, you know, both in liberal and conservative ecumenical organizations. But again, there wasn't any kind of headquarters back in Geneva or Zurich saying, now we're going to send out people here and there. It just happened. And it's been that work of those people for whom it just happened that is, if there's any success, and, you know, you can measure that in various ways, and some people might say Calvinism is a failure, but still, it's that ordinary work that made the engine run.
Yeah, that's evident, you know, as you already mentioned, just in the circumstances that brought Calvin to Geneva. And we have a whole host of issues at work in the rise and even genesis of Calvinism back then. Could you describe some of those factors that were at work even during the Reformation that allowed for and also maybe incubated Calvinism and even then the Lutheran and Reformed traditions? What was going on in society as well as in the church that brought Calvinism about?
Well, again, some of it was accidental in the sense that the important cities in Zurich and Geneva, and Geneva wasn't even part of the Swiss Confederation at the beginning of the Reformation, but the Swiss had a kind of autonomy, and of course they still do to this day. I mean, the Swiss are remarkable for preserving their independence, but they had autonomy both from the emperor and the pope in a way, so that the city councils in some of those cities could actually, when Luther's ideas began to circulate and Protestant ministers began to run with them, like Ulrich Zwingli, they could actually begin to think about reforming the churches and taking an independent stance without maybe getting killed. It didn't hurt, though, of course, that the Turks were invading Eastern Europe and creating and diverting all sorts of resources that might have been used against Protestants, but had to be used to fight the Muslims. But there was just a widespread concern for reform as well, because of the experience of the papacy in the 14th century, when you had the Avignon papacy and the Western Schism. It looked like the papacy was on the ropes. There were councils to try to reform that in the 15th century. But, you know, university professors, priests throughout Europe were calling for reform. And, of course, Luther took that farther, and there would be a break between the humanists and the Protestants. But that general sense of a desire for reform, you know, not to mention the possibilities of some economic factors at play as well, with the rise of, say, a middle class or some kind of entrepreneurial spirit, which would have also taken issue with some of the received patterns of order and authority in Europe. But still, when it comes specifically to Switzerland and the cities in Switzerland, you just have this remarkable constellation of independent factors that allow the cities, for instance, of Zurich and Bern and Basel and eventually Geneva, to function in a way of gaining some independence for these reforms. And then those reforms begin to leak out because of writings and also the politics of trying to actually defend Protestantism, form alliances. You know, and then I think what really is important, though, is what happens in Scotland and the Netherlands, where you have the formation, in effect, of new nations or national identities, both in Scotland and the Netherlands, and those being identified explicitly with either Presbyterian or Reformed works. And those become the big exporters of Reformed Protestantism through colonialism or imperialism. The Scots tag along with the British and or the English, and the Dutch themselves are very much a colonial enterprise, not nearly as big as the English, but still they're exporting Calvinism down to South America and Indonesia and also North America.
Yeah, in a big way.
Mm-hmm. And so once Protestantism, Reformed Protestantism kicks in with the Scots and the Dutch it really does seem that Reformed Protestantism is going to spread in some intriguing ways.
You see, with, you know, beginning there in Switzerland, especially in Geneva, and as you've mentioned, you know, Scotland and England and Netherlands, we can get into all those contexts as well. But really what goes on in every one of them is a unique relation between church and state, or church and magistrate, however government is formed in those different locations. How did politics and ecclesial reform relate in these various locations?
Well, I guess I wound up emphasizing politics, not simply because of my own interest in it, but also because I wanted to reach a wider audience, which mm-hmm. is what my editors wanted to do. And most people are, politics is more interesting to most people than, say, church government, even mm-hmm. though it's a kind of politics as well. But it was crucial for Protestants to have patrons of the state in order to protect them from either whatever kind of political resources the Pope could marshal, or from the emperor, or from, say, a Roman Catholic monarch, say, in France, which never really materialized for the Huguenots. So without state support, without state sanction, without becoming an established church politically, the Reformed churches would not have existed. And that's just the reality of it. But it does seem that, I mean, what's striking is that in the Netherlands, you have a kind of Republican government, and these provinces that try to unite, much in the way that the states in the United States eventually would try to unite and have some fits and starts about that. But in Scotland, you have a monarchy, and that monarchy winds up really producing headaches for the Presbyterian Church in Scotland once that monarchy, the Stuart monarchy, becomes the monarch of a united thrones of Scotland and England, eventually leading to the union of Scotland and England. But then you have these quirky little independent cities in Switzerland where the city councils are running things. And so what's striking about Reformed Protestant history or Calvinist history is how variable or various it all is. It's not, there's not one pattern that fits all. There's not one pattern that's necessarily more successful than the others. So I continued to be struck by this, the diversity of it all, and the sort of defiance of any kind of law or generalization that you could make about this. And maybe that's partly in the end what makes Reformed Protestantism as successful as it is, depending how you want to slice that, because it wasn't run top down. It was sort of adapting as the churches spread, as circumstances varied politically and economically. It was able to adjust, and I think it's a big theme. Also, a book that I did rely on very much in work on the project, Philip Benedict's Christ Church is Purely Reformed, which is a masterpiece of historical scholarship in my estimation. But he covers Reformed churches up until 1700. So I was really thankful to have that as a resource to help construct the narrative. But he makes the point specifically about how adaptive the Reformed Protestants were. And, you know, it may reflect the Presbyterian form of government, where you do have not a top-down bishop hierarchical kind of government where one person's calling the shots, but you have these councils or committees that are meeting that may make them more flexible in certain ways. So that there's a dovetail then perhaps between the political arrangements at the state or city level and then with the governmental arrangements within the churches themselves.
Wow. Dr. Hart, obviously, you know, politics and reform on grand display in the English Reformation. What can you tell us in terms of a little more detail about characters like Henry and Thomas Cromwell and Thomas Cranmer?
Probably not much more than what I say in the book, because they probably appear on three or four pages. But obviously, I mean, with the English Reformation is again one of those one of the more compelling narratives in Reformation history because of a more or less ne'er-do-well king, no offense to Henry VIII, who has marital fidelity issues, we might say.
He has issues, but yeah.
You know, it is this problem of the search for a successor to the throne, and that winds up, you know, yielding in Edward VI, and so you have this. I mean, Cromwell tried to find Henry a wife who would produce a male heir, and one could argue that he was successful. Although I can't really remember which wife it was that Cromwell succeeded, and then which one he failed with, because he eventually was executed, just like Thomas More. But you know, it does eventually produce the male heir of Edward VI, where the English Church does come into its own more as a reformed, in a more reformed orbit, at least theologically. Not necessarily if you think episcopacy is in some ways an issue, but you know, his monarchy, Edward VI, lasts only 6 years to be succeeded by Mary Tudor, mm-hmm. and but there the irony is, again, she produces these exiles from the English Protestant Church who go over to the continent and see the way that the churches are being done, say, in Frankfurt or Geneva or Bern or Basel, and they come back with these ideas inspired. I should also mention, though, that under Edward VI, I mean, England becomes a home for refugees from the continent. So people like Bucer the Polish reformer, whose name I'm forgetting right now.
Mm-hmm.
But some of these figures are ministering in London or teaching at Oxford and Cambridge. So there's a real cross-fertilization going on between the continent and England during the 40s and 50s that winds up stimulating Reformed Protestant developments on both sides of the channel, as it were. So as say, dicey and as undesirable, perhaps, as the English Reformation was, it really wound up being a very pivotal setting for mm-hmm. the transfer of Reformed Protestant ideas. And then again, when the English become a colonial power and have the Scots tagging along or the Puritans expanding Calvinist notions, England really winds up being a very important patron, as it were, unlikely and unintentional, but patron of Calvinism. And mm-hmm. I mean, one of the things I've been struck by, I'm working on a talk right now for a presentation I need to make, and there was a discussion last summer, I guess, about why no Lutheran Baptists, why Calvinistic Baptists. And one of the things that came out in that discussion was that English culture or English empire didn't really have many Lutherans as part of the furniture. Calvinism was part of the furniture. I mean, the English, in effect, kind of domesticated Calvinism so that people in the English-speaking world think they know something about Calvinism, whether they do or not. But it's one of these brands that you can sort of point to, like BMW or Starbucks or something. And you say Calvinism, people have an idea, an association with it, whereas Lutheranism is completely unfamiliar, which again is ironic because the English were certainly, the English church was certainly reluctant in throwing in its lot with the Reformed churches. But yet it wound up really extending, both through the Puritans and through the Scottish Presbyterians, extending Reformed churches around mm-hmm. the world. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You know, that a lot of this occurs in your chapter you've titled God's Fickle Anointed, and it just strikes me as you continue to describe this, and after I've, you know, already read this chapter, of how Calvinism is strengthening and improving and spreading, either by the protection of the fickle anointed or by the persecution that comes from his or her government, because they spread and it causes exile. So we see God at work in unusual ways. Now, we've heard in you know, a lot about English history. We're familiar with the Reformation in Switzerland, if we're familiar at all with church history. But not too many people may be familiar with the Reformation in France, and then especially in Eastern Europe. Do you have any thoughts, or could you share anything with our listeners about how the Calvinism spread to France, but then also to Eastern Europe?
Well, this isn't in the book when it comes to France, but I've been, you know, you can't help but be struck by something going on in the French water to produce someone like Calvin himself. I mean, Calvin was a Frenchman,
yeah.
First and last, and Geneva really becomes it's a French-speaking part of Switzerland, but it really becomes sort of the center for French Reformed Protestants. And there's a long history, even down to the 18th century with the French Revolution, of the Gallican or French Church trying to establish its own autonomy from the papacy. And, you know, one could argue that the French Revolution itself is in some ways a product of that rivalry between the Gallican Church and the papacy. So there's something in the water in France that makes it receptive to Luther's ideas and to calls for reform and calls for putting the papacy in check. But of course, the politics of the French monarchy are very difficult to negotiate. So, but that also means that France winds up sending French-speaking Protestants north into the Netherlands,
mm-hmm.
the Low Countries, where they are partly responsible for helping the Dutch achieve their own independence and reform those churches. I mean, Guido de Bry is a French name who's in the Spanish-controlled portion of the Netherlands, and he's a martyr to the cause in the 1560s. But I know people in Dutch reform circles to this day whose names are French, and yet they're considered Dutch because the Netherlands became a home for some of those Huguenots. So the French, both because of Calvin, but also because of the influence that they had going north into the Netherlands, are very important. And there are some interesting connections as well with northern German-speaking regions, too, affinities between the French and the German speakers. So, you know, you don't want to leave out the French, even though they don't wind up gaining support, positive support from the French monarchy. Now, what happens in Eastern Europe is, again, I think it's partly a function of the opportunities that were available to nobles in places like Poland, Lithuania, and Hungary, who, if they were trying to achieve some kind of autonomy, both from the emperor and the papacy, they could perhaps do so by also creating some clearance religiously. And so, you know, at a certain point for them, Lutheranism or Reformed Protestantism would have been options, but I think maybe Reformed Protestantism wound up being appealing, maybe because it was more systematic, maybe because the understandings of worship were more direct and sort of created more autonomy in a way. But I also think it's largely because Reformed works were beginning to circulate and were more available in some ways, and Calvin's Academy and some other educational institutions in Switzerland provide forums for leaders to send their ministers or priests to receive more education. But that winds up not being lasting very long. And here's one of the successes of the Counter-Reformation, where the Jesuits receive their commission and establish schools in Eastern Europe, and eventually the nobility who are calling for reform and sponsoring reformed churches in this late 16th century wind up sending their own children to Jesuit schools. And so the reformed church life doesn't extend probably beyond two generations in some of those places. Although the Hungarian church continues to be strong to this day. Strong, but continues to exist. And the Hungarian reformed are a presence that a lot of sort of typical Scottish or Dutch-inspired reform folk don't know much about.
A question about Germany, because oftentimes we think Germany, we think the Lutheran Church and Lutheranism, and yet, of course, the German Reformed Church was very much a force to be reckoned with in some regards. But particularly because early on you've got the rise of the Heidelberg Catechism. That also was actually supported by a magisterial patron, right?
Yes. I guess it was Frederick.
Yeah, it was Frederick.
The third. Yes. And again, the empire was carved up into all these different regions and territories with princes overseeing those. So if you could get a prince on your side you were in good shape. The problem was is that the prince would be succeeded by a son, and then what would happen? Would that son also be supportive? So the church in the Palatinate in Heidelberg went between Reformed and Lutheran partly because of the children of Frederick III, as I recall. I may not be getting that entirely right, but then eventually Roman Catholics take over the province as well, at least in the 18th century. And so, you know, when you have rule by a single person, even if it's only within a contained geographic region, it's going to mean you're going to have you're going to be very dependent on the swings of the fortunes of that family. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the reason why I think if there is one general rule you can take away from some of the early history of Reformed churches is that when you were dependent on a monarch, you were going to have a tougher time than, say, if you were dependent on a city council or some kind of republican arrangement, say, in the Netherlands. Even though, of course, there were many difficulties in the Netherlands, and the churches in Switzerland and in Zurich and Geneva were by no means safe or foolproof from liberalism eventually coming along later in the 17th and 18th centuries. But still, you weren't necessarily prone to the kind of lurching to Lutheranism or Roman Catholicism, depending on the change of one person, one generation of rule.
Well, do you have any thoughts, Daryl, with regard to the way that things shift dramatically, it seems? And you bring this up in the book, when you move from a church that's under the blessings or the curses of a monarch or a civil magistrate, versus when it kind of gets exported, particularly to the Americas, and then it finds itself in more of a democratic type of situation. What are the challenges that democratic atmosphere brought to the church?
Well, I would say, you don't really have explicitly democratic arrangements in Reformed churches, except for the Puritans in New England, and they sort of conduct a much more congregational polity than elsewhere. And by the time of the halfway covenant, you know, they're trying to figure out what all this means. That's not simply the function of a congregational polity, but certainly that's experiencing difficulties there by the 1660s. But in the colonies in North America, for instance, there's much more room for experimentation, partly because the colonial officials don't seem to be all that concerned about which church is conducting services. As long as they are Christian, they want churches, they know or they think that religion is important to the social order. But as long as there's one of these Protestants, and there's still a clear division between Protestants and Roman Catholics, as long as there are some churches, we're willing to sort of go whatever's in play. So when the English come to New York, they keep the Dutch Reformed churches going sort of as the quasi-establishment for three or four decades. And it's part of the reason why the Dutch Reformed churches are still so prominent in parts of New York, especially along the Hudson River, in the Hudson River Valley. But so, you know, once you get away from Europe and the established order there, whether it be prince or emperor or king or city council, you can have more room for maneuvering. And again, if Reformed Protestantism has a kind of flexibility built into it, it may be possible to flourish outside the patronage of the state, and maybe you can even make a go of it as a voluntary church, which is what the Presbyterians did in North America, in what will become the United States, as well as the German Reformed. They figured out early on how to become a kind of voluntary church where they were not receiving any support from the state. They were not getting really any support from the European churches. They were having to sustain themselves either through tent-making sort of operations or raising contributions from donors. But that was an important lesson to learn for those churches in the early part of the 18th century that would then carry over once all sorts of governments would eventually disestablish churches. Mm-hmm. That was an important lesson that gave them in some ways an upper hand when, say, 1789 brings the French Revolution to Europe, the American Revolution, and a new relationship between church and state.
You find that with the Dutch Reformed you've already mentioned in New York, but not only are they, you know, Dutch Reformed, Dutch people, colonists that are operating in some sort of neutral place, but they're operating in an English colony that is under the authority of a different magistrate with its own proclivities toward its own types of churches. So there's all sorts of complexities going on in that early time.
Well, you have the colonial government, you have the monarchy and parliament. And they're trying to sort it out too. It's not like the parliament and the monarchy always get along. And then you have the bishops on top of that. So, you know, there are all sorts of levels to negotiate. But when you're an ocean away, there's a lot more freedom. So, this is one of the great ironies that people in the West today, and for good reason, beat themselves up over colonialism and what Europeans did to indigenous persons all around the world. But on the other hand, without colonialism, we would not have Reformed Protestantism in North America.
Yeah.
It wasn't the Native Americans were going to make a call to Geneva and say, could you send us some pastors over here, please? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right. Do you see a connection at all between I mean, this is kind of my theory. I'll go ahead and throw it out there, and you feel free to just talk about it or what have you. But it seems as if when the church comes over, particularly to America, and you're dealing with a situation where, especially after the Revolution, there is a break between the church and the state. You now have a free, voluntary church. And I just wonder if that voluntary situation didn't, in fact, breed a kind of entrepreneurialism that may have fed into the later revivals and that particular kind of a approach of a kind of a one-man show type of ministry and approach to doing church and the expansion of the church throughout America.
No, I think that's exactly right. I mean, I do think that there are responsible ways of being an entrepreneur, and there are irresponsible ways. But every church in a voluntary environment has to be entrepreneurial in some ways. You have to be able to sustain your ministry through the contributions voluntarily given, through members who voluntarily come because they're not going to be coerced by the state. It's not going to be part of the requirements for citizenship in the state or the colony. So that does force people to be entrepreneurial. And then the question is whether you can do so within the conventions or practices of your communion, meaning the Book of Church Order, for instance, or whether you're going to really spice it up and think outside the box and do things that probably are not really within the bounds of your communion's understanding of ministry. So, you know, it's easy to see how revivalism could come in that set of circumstances. You know, the intriguing thing about the First Great Awakening, so-called, with George Whitfield, for instance, is that he is, and this is part of what makes Whitfield pretty remarkable, is that he's taking his campaigns both into places where there are established churches as well as there are places where there are no churches that are established. The difference, say, between Pennsylvania, where there is religious pluralism, or Massachusetts, where there is a state church system. And he's generally successful both places, even though he receives opposition, and the opposition is somewhat different in both places, but still, it's not until the so-called Second Great Awakening that you have entrepreneurialism perhaps run amok. But there's still constraints in some ways on that First Awakening in the colonial setting because of this state system still in place.
Daryl, obviously, you know, Presbyterian types, many of our listeners, we lean on the confessional standards, the Westminster standards, et cetera. And obviously, I remember years ago reading the Christian's ABCs and just the impact of confessional writing and catechetical writing and that kind of thing in, you know, the spread of Reformation. But specifically, the Heidelberg Catechism was so influential. Can you speak a little bit to the rise and influence of the Heidelberg Catechism for the Reformation?
Well, again, it arises. I mean, there are many catechisms. If you've looked at Jim Dennison's, you know, several volumes of confessions. Anyway, you know, practically, you know, every pastor, maybe every other pastor, is writing a catechism. You know, because it's they need to teach doctrine to their people, But Heidelberg winds up obviously defining the churches in the Palatinate, and then because of the cooperation between the Dutch and the Germans, and the Synod of Emden, I believe, is sort of the place, safe place for some of the Dutch Reform to meet for a while while the war is still going on with Spain. And so, you know, so when Heidelberg latches on with the Dutch, and still to this day, of course, it's one of the three forms of unity. Right. When the Dutch begin to plant churches around the world, because again of colonialism, the Heidelberg is going to be there. Now, it's what's striking too, though, is the German Reformed have never embraced Dort or the Belgic Confession.
It hasn't gone both ways, they've relied
solely on Heidelberg, you know, and that's part of their own sort of self-understanding. Although one of the striking things about the German Reformed in the United States, their hero, if you go back to some of the older histories of the German Reformed in America, you know, they'll have sort of someone on the inside cover, you know, sort of who the big guy is, and it's always Zwingli, because Zwingli, of course, was a German-speaking reformer, and he's there at the beginning of Reformed Protestantism.
Yeah,
but it's not someone like Ursinus necessarily, or Oecolampadius. That's not to say that those guys aren't important, but because, you know, Zwingli is 40 years before Heidelberg, they sort of look back to the, you know, original origins as much as they could. And I guess it's striking too in the United States that you have a college named for Ursinus, though, and not for Zwingli. So maybe they switch on that at a certain point because, I mean, I think Ursinus was formed around 1880, and there was a controversy within the church, and I think maybe they wanted to claim that part of their heritage more at that point, at least the people who founded it. But again, I think it's the connection that develops between the Netherlands and Germany that's responsible for highlighting Heidelberg in comparison to the other catechisms that may have been available.
Right.
And then also in North America, I mean, a very, for me, fascinating part of the narrative was to see the way that the German Reformed in North America had to lean on the Dutch Reformed, so that some of the initial churches within the German Reformed, German-speaking communities of Reformed churches were under the oversight of the Classis Amsterdam, because there was no real parent body to whom the German Reform could appeal. They were being led by people who weren't really ordained, so they needed help from the Dutch. And the Dutch in North America then tied the Germans to the Dutch back in the old country. So you have, again, these cultural ties between the Dutch and the Germans, also that, as I mentioned, involve the French in certain ways, to get this thing called the Three Forms of Unity. So you really have sort of a French-speaking document from the Belgic, the canons of Dort themselves, which are the Dutch product, and then you have Heidelberg, which is a German-speaking product, which gives the Dutch church a kind of interesting multicultural background.
Mm-hmm. Now, obviously the Dutch Reformed communities spread for various reasons, and Daryl, you would know, obviously, living in Michigan, that there's quite a Dutch influence there. We also have up in Alberta and Canada, also throughout Wisconsin and other places in Iowa, that there are these enclaves of Dutch Reformed theology. I'd love to speak about that and expand on that probably in an entire episode. I don't know if we're going to have time to be able to do that in the final minutes. I think what would be interesting, though, is if you could explain for us more of the German Reformed influence, if we could follow that thread into the Americas, especially in Pennsylvania. Early on, you mentioned John Philip Baim. And the fact that he's a major figure, however, most people never heard of him. How did he come into Germantown in Pennsylvania, and how does he relate to figures like Francis McAmey? And really, what has happened with the German Reformed movement throughout that whole thread? It's not clearly as popular as American Presbyterianism or the English right. and Scottish influence. What happened, and why are things the way they are now?
One way of getting into this answer is to I've done a little work on immigration to the United States, and it's very funny to read quotations from Benjamin Franklin, who you consider to be fairly liberal and a great patriot and statesman, but he's concerned about all the Germans coming into Pennsylvania, and he actually refers to them as black. That the English were white and the Germans were black. So the Germans were considered, even though Penn set up a colony that would be a home to all these dissenting groups in Europe, English were suspicious of the Germans. Mm-hmm. So it goes well back beyond World War I. And so Baim came to America. There were warfare still, religious warfare. So he came to just try to make a better life for himself. He was a school teacher back in the old country. And because he had some learning when he arrived, the colonists, German settlers, asked him to be a minister because he had the book learning necessary to do it. So he reluctantly accepted.
Wow.
And then eventually the German Reform did send some pastors to North America, and they took issue with whether Baim himself could be technically a minister. And that's what led to an appeal to the Dutch to help them sort this out. And eventually Baim did become ordained by the Dutch church, and things worked out for them. But the German Reformed, because they were a very agricultural community, very much spread out, it was hard for them to gain a kind of institutional coherence, so that they don't really form a seminary until the 1820s at Mercersburg.
Yeah.
And John Williamson Nevin, who is a Presbyterian in background, eventually becomes a professor there in 1830 or so, and tries to, again, give more institutional heft to the German Reformed. And that winds up fracturing the church in some way, so that the Eastern Church is considered to be more liberal. The Eastern Synod, which is largely Pennsylvania, the Western Synod, largely Ohio, is considered to be more conservative. But as is the case with so many Protestant communions in the United States after the Civil War, union is a great cultural ideal in the United States. And so the German Reformed eventually began to participate in the ecumenical movement, so that by 1934, the German Reformed Church, then known as the RCUS, Reformed Church of the United States, merges with the Evangelical and Reformed Church, which was the church out of which the Niebuhrs came, and eventually that merged church from 1834 merges, ironically, with the United Churches of Christ, which is basically the Puritan denomination. So you have these German communions merging with the formerly English communion, the UCC, which means that today the United Church of Christ somehow in its cultural memory has to include John Winthrop, John Williamson Nevin, John Boehm, as well as Jeremiah Wright and Reinhold Niebuhr.
Oh,
I mean,
my.
Talk about
it's fascinating.
Mix.
It's eclectic.
but that's what happens to ecumenism in the 20th century. You sort of lose the differences between those various groups, and they all become one.
Yeah, there merges and in different ecumenical mergers, you end up losing some of the ethnic heritage. Now, by the end of the 18th century, in your opinion or your estimation, which Calvinist group was in the best position in the New World? I'll let you interpret that, what it means to be in the best position. But by the end of the 18th century, which Calvinist group, either Swiss, Dutch, German, English, or maybe Scots-Irish, who was in the best position, do you think, in the New World?
It would have to be, and I don't want to sound like a Homer on this, but it would have to be the Presbyterians.
Mm-hmm.
Vying with the New England Puritans, because both are English-speaking communions, and they're, even though the United States is breaking with England or the United Kingdom, the English speakers have an advantage that other communions don't have. And so they will be much closer to positions of power. So, for instance, even cultural institutions like the Ivy League institutions, when you think of Harvard, Yale, mm-hmm. and Princeton and Columbia, though, you know, so the Presbyterians have access to one of those and largely controlling Princeton. Yale is Puritan. Harvard's going to go Unitarian. But the German, the Swiss, the French, they just don't have access to those institutions. So that even to this day, for instance, Franklin and Marshall, which is one of the German Reform institutions, a very nice, very good liberal arts institution in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, it does not have the cultural pizzazz of Harvard, Yale, or Princeton.
Yeah.
So, and I think that's going to hurt, though, the Presbyterians in some ways, that they will be too close to the informal establishment in the United States. You know, and I think Machen and some of the old Princeton guys in the 20th century are going to have to try to sort some of that out. But still, the late 18th century, I would say the Presbyterians are the best positioned.
Mm. Yeah, that's really fascinating. I hate to say it, but I think, you know, we're definitely haven't paced ourselves very well in this episode, but
it's been fantastic.
Yeah,
it really has.
I should say, you know, we're definitely going to have you back sometime, Daryl, if you're willing
to
talk about more of these chapters, because I want the listeners to know that there's just fascinating sections here on missions, missionary zeal. There's also church rupture. We haven't even touched upon the major events happening in the 19th century, especially between 1834 and 1843. There were so many big events happening in Calvinist churches, thinking in Scotland, but also here between old school and new school in America. The Netherlands influence and all the things that were going on in the Dutch church, especially in the New World, is fascinating. So there's so many more threads that we can trace out, and we will do so in the future. So for the time being, I would encourage all the listeners to go pick up a copy of this book, Calvinism, A History. It's from Yale University Press, but it's still affordable. I think it's the mid-30s, about $34 or so. You can find the street price thereabouts, but a fine, fine volume. Just over 300 pages and just a great binding, good paper and everything for all the book nerds who are out there.
If I could just say one last thing, at least in this episode, I would encourage readers that if it seems overwhelming because of the variety of episodes that are in the book, that's partly the intent.
Yeah.
you sort of just need to be sort of submerged in the variety of episodes that come at you in this book. And,
right.
you know, eventually, maybe once you've read through them, a pattern will emerge, I think. At least I tried to render one. And it does, in my own mind, I think a pattern has emerged.
Mm-hmm.
But also part of the, I think part of the fun of certainly writing this was to just to be overwhelmed by the variety. And so if that's happening, enjoy it. Don't let it trouble you, at least for a while. So.
No, I think it's useful, and you've taken a similar tact with this book as you have in your recent OP history and some of your other volumes, where each chapter will be more of a theme, and then you trace the whole theme out from all the different strands around the world and through time. So it's not as if chapter two is necessarily chronologically after chapter one, at least in toto. So it's interesting there,
right.
And it's a useful way, I think, to have done this. And I very much appreciate how you've organized this, and also any contribution your editors
might
have made.
Well, I appreciate you saying that, because it really was a challenge to try
to get
the book covers around this.
Yeah, obviously.
In some ways, this is a great sort of, I don't want to call it a companion volume, but sort of a prequel volume to Daryl's other book, Seeking a Better Country, which is fantastic.
Yeah, with Mether.
You
need to read that book as well. And if you want more, the listeners want more information about American Presbyterianism, that book is indispensable. But this book is going to provide more of the Calvinist history and, you know, really fascinating treatment on Dutch Reformed, the Dutch Reformed movement. And I'd like to look into that more as we turn our attention as an organization, as Reformed Forum. I'd love to speak about that more often. And there's just so much there that a lot of Presbyterians, I think, are unfamiliar. But those are our brothers. And many people in our OPC and PCA churches and other Reformed churches are coming from a Dutch heritage as well. So it's important for us to speak about those and not neglect a huge branch of Calvinism, perhaps even one of the most influential branches at different times throughout history. So we'll have you back, Daryl, sometime, and let's talk about these things. But
that'd be great.
It'll be exciting. You can find David Filson online at teachinglikerain.wordpress.com. That's his website. Daryl, of course, is online. Many of you already know, but you can visit him at oldlife.org. A lot of posts going up there every few days. Recently, you know, talking a lot about transformationalism and continuing on his 2K subject. You can find Daryl this fall. He's going to be speaking at some conferences. I don't have the dates in front of me, but if you go to reformedforum.org, right on the homepage, we have a post there on 2013 conferences in the fall. Daryl's going to be speaking at the Reformed in America conference, the subtitle here, An Exploration of the History of Reformed and Presbyterian Christianity in the States. That's going to be in Des Moines, Iowa, and it's hosted, co-hosted by Grace Reformed Presbyterian Church and Providence Reformed Church. Daryl Hart and Alan Strange will be there November 1st and 2nd, so check that out. Reformed in America, more information on that is available on our website. Just visit reformedforum.org. Of course, you can send us a note, mail at reformedforum.org, or tweet us at reformedforum. We love hearing from you. We want to thank everybody for listening, and we hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.